Meeting of the Health and Human Services Finance Committee will come to order. We do have a quorum present. We don't have a quorum present. Evidently, some people are still having lunch or other things. So that being mind, we are going to proceed with our first presentation, Mr. Pittsburgher. I'm going to have you start off things, but at some point we will interrupt for parliamentary procedures. So with that, welcome to the committee, and if you could introduce yourself and proceed with your presentation.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dan Kitzberger. I'm the Legislative Director for the Direct Care and Treatment Administration at DHS. Today we have an overview. I'm just going to provide a brief overview of the quarterly report on the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center, the Minnesota Security Hospital, and the Community Behavioral Health Hospitals. This is as a result of legislation that was passed during the 2016 legislative session. In that time, we began issuing these reports in the beginning of fiscal year 17, so we've issued six reports throughout that time. The information that's contained in the report, so the data points, are spelled out in statute for us. And we will add notes to the report from time to time. So as you look at the report, on page one is obviously just the data that we provide each quarter. The second page is where we add some notes that we feel if there's, you know, a change of a notable nature from quarter to quarter, we'll just note that. So for example, in recordable injuries, they doubled at Anoka since the last quarter. So we just wanted to note that that was as a result of a specific incident that resulted with one patient that resulted in multiple injuries. And then on pages 3 and 4 of the report are the various definitions contained within it. So we spell out our facilities, how an OSHA recordable injury is defined, and then the kind of the breakout of the positions that are described within the first page of the data. And I know, Mr. Chair, that it says on the first page that questions can be referred to me. However, today we have a few executives from our business area present to answer specific questions.
Questions from members. Members, there was included in your packet with regard to the quarterly report a letter issued by the Executive Director for NAMI. I'll just point that out. So no further questions. Thank you for your presentation. Next up, we have a presentation from DHS on the electronic visit verification system. Alex Bartolik. Welcome to the committee. And if you could formally just introduce yourself to the committee and then provide us with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Alex Bartolik. I'm with the Department of Human Services, and I'm here to talk to you about electronic visit verifications. This is something that was addressed last year through the legislature. We have done work and have a report now about the next steps. This started with federal legislation known in the 21st Century Cures Act that set up a standard for verifying that services have been delivered to people. It applies to personal care services, and I'm going to talk about the scope a little bit more as we go into this, but this includes our Medicaid services through home care as well as through our home and community-based waiver services. And if states choose not to implement an EVV system, there is a reduction in federal participation in our Medicaid program. And there is one set of standards for personal care-related services by January 1st, 2019, to be implementing a system. And then there also are additional standards by January 1st, 2023, that we have to implement EVV systems for home health services as we go forward. The CARES Act does provide federal funding. It provides a 90% match for the development and initial setup of the system, and then there's 75% federal match for the ongoing cost of the operations and maintenance. The services that this involves includes our personal care assistance services, which is available through our home care state plan. So it's something that when people are eligible for medical assistance and meet the eligibility standards, the functional need limitations, they can then access services. But it also will apply to our community for services and supports, which our personal care program will shift to, and home and community-based services that are provided through the waivers when those services include activities that help the person with their personal needs or with their household. And by January 1st, in 2023, the scope of services will expand to home health services, which include those through home health agencies, but also medical supplies and equipment.
Ms. Bartolik, I just want to interrupt you for just a second and announce that we do have a quorum. So I'm formally bringing this committee to order. And with that, Mr. Representative Heinzman moves the minutes from March 6th. Would there be any additions or subtractions? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion prevails and the minutes are approved. With that, please continue.
We were talking about the scope of services. We are still waiting for further guidance from the federal government, from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, about the whole scope of services, but we do have enough to understand that it does apply to personal care and some of these home and community-based services. What does this system do? Some of it does what Minnesota's already put in place through much of our reforms in how we authorize and bill for services, but there are some additions. So it includes six main components: what type of service was delivered, who received the services, the date of service, and what's unique is the location where the service was delivered. We also then provide, say, who provided the service and when it begins and ends. We worked with a number of stakeholders. We did a lot of work evaluating what's happening across the country, what current providers are using. There are systems that a number of providers have in place. They use it for scheduling, for payroll, and it would have the capacity to also include the requirements of an EVV system. And we have other providers who don't have a system. So after working over the past year, we did recommend a hybrid system where providers would have an option from using a state-purchased EVV system, so if they don't have a system or if they prefer to do that, or they can use an EVV system that they have access to as long as it meets minimum criteria. This allows providers to meet the best system for their or allows them to select the best system to meet their business needs. It allows those providers who currently have been using a system to not have to change as long as that system adjusts, and yet makes something available for providers who don't have a system. All of these services, though, will be reported through a centralized data aggregator. And we also recommended that there be cost-sharing mechanisms in order to support providers in designing and meeting the processes for these new requirements. Some of the key features of a data aggregator, which I mentioned and is a little bit different than what we've done in the past, is having a way for all these systems, regardless if someone is using a state-purchased EVV system or their own EVV system, is for all of this data to come into one central location, managed through a third party, in order to compile all of this information. And this allows the state to do post-payment review of claims for these personal care services and home health services that are subject to the EVV system. When we were doing our work over the past year and working with stakeholders, we relied on both the requirements in the federal law in the CARES Act, but also on legislation that was passed last year. And some of the principles is to try to reduce the administrative and financial burden to the provider but also to assure that the service recipient does not have excessive burden in this process. We do not want to disrupt services. It's important that services are provided to people where they need them, whether it's at home, in the community, in a workplace. We also wanted to assure that the systems we were looking at look at best practices and look at what's going on across the country to build on that, and that it's conducted, obviously, according to all state and federal laws. We worked quite a bit with stakeholders. We held 14 public meetings between August and December of 2017. Four of those meetings were done in a way that allowed remote participation for people who couldn't attend. And attendees included people who use services, providers, included people from health plans, it included people who provide EVV services. And all of this was looking at what is the feedback that they had for us. And there was some conflicting feedback as we went forward, but we knew that what people were saying is that this, how we manage the EVV system, has to really allow them to live lives the way that they want to live them, where they want to go. We need to avoid rigid scheduling. There are times where the system could take a schedule and verify did people show up according to schedule, but if somebody's life changed and they wanted to change the schedule, the person receiving services wanting to assure that there was the ability for them to have the flexibility to do that. It needed to have flexibility for internet access. Many of these systems do rely on cell phones and other mechanisms, but we might not always have access to that type of technology wherever a person is located. Had to be easy to use regardless of language, particularly in our personal care program. We have many people, both who receive services and who deliver services, for whom English is not their first language, and we need to make sure that it is easy to use. And also, really, a lot of concerns about the privacy for people. Many of the people who receive services are concerned about what's going to happen to information about their lives, particularly if it relies on pictures or some type of GPS system. And so there's a lot of concerns about how do we manage the data privacy going forward. As we look at next steps and some of the considerations of what we need to do to implement this by January 1st of 2019, one, we need continued engagement with stakeholders, and we want to reach out to a greater extent with people who receive services in order to make sure that this is responding to the concerns that they have. We need to develop cost-sharing mechanisms to assure that it's not a undue financial burden for providers, both to initiate this as well as the ongoing costs. We also would like to use a request for proposal process to be able to solicit and select a vendor for a state EVV system, and also to solicit a vendor for the third-party data aggregator that will be necessary and used by all providers across the state. So there was more information in the report. It is a work in progress. Be happy to answer any other questions if you have them.
Questions from committee members? Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Assistant Commissioner. I'm glad that you've been engaging a lot of people in this discussion, and I see that some of the feedback has been people would like to use current technology rather than having us tied to a vendor who may change models or drop out of the business or whatever. And given the low income levels of the people who are providing this, at least many of them, and how difficult it is to find workers, I wonder if there might be some, if you've considered ways in which we might actually enhance the support for those individuals who are doing this work and that we have great vacancies in. For example, I'm thinking it looks like many people supported the use of a cell phone. And if, you know, the program could cover the cost of their cell phone and allow for them to, you know, have personal use on it as well, or be paid even for the use of their personal phone or something, so they don't have to carry two different devices and you know, that's a cost burden to everyone. But particularly for low-wage workers, when we're having a hard time getting people to apply for jobs for $11 or $12 an hour, anything we can do in implementing this that's less of a burden and actually helps stretch their personal budget, I think would be great. And are you looking at phone-based services in some manner?
Ms. Portale.
Mr. Chair and Representative Loeffler, There's a number of systems. Some of them are phone-based systems, and that is certainly an option. We also have people, though, for example, who are concerned about a phone-based system, particularly if it's on their personal phone. We have some people who are not able to manipulate the phone, and they would actually have to rely on somebody else to get in and do it for them. And so we're just trying to understand all the different pros and cons. Part of the solicitation process of inviting responses from possible vendors, as well as working with current vendors to see what they would need to do to manage it, will help us understand what does that mean for devices, what does that mean for ease of use.
Representative Laffer.
Thank you very much, and I just say continue to keep listening to the workers who will actually be using this. And I noticed that all of your input meetings were in the afternoon during a normal workday, so that isn't really conducive to necessarily getting their input.
Any other questions? I understand you have another presentation that's upcoming in front of us on the the Disability Waiver Financial Management Program. So why don't we just launch right into that one as well.
And I'm going to ask for one of my technical assistance folks. The next one is on our Disability Waiver Financial Management and Waiting List. And this is a good news report. This is something that represents a great deal of investment both by the legislature as well as by many, many stakeholders to look at how we can improve access to home and community-based services. This report outlines work that has been done through county and tribal management of our four disability waiver programs and what's been done to manage waiting lists and, in one case, eliminate it. The four programs, if you're not familiar with the disability waivers, include our developmental disabilities waiver. It includes a waiver that's called Community Access for Disability Inclusion, or CADI. This is a waiver for people who are at risk of nursing home level of care. We have the Community Alternative Care, or CAC, program for people who would otherwise reside in hospitals. And then we also have a waiver for people with brain injury that allows for some of those specialized services as we go forward. Minnesota manages these programs through counties and tribal agencies. We manage them on an aggregate average. There was a time when there were more limits that were specified per person, but these are lifelong services, and once people are on, we need services that are flexible across different variations of the lifespan. So managing these programs on an aggregate average allows any one person to have services that can vary according to their needs, as long as on the average we are spending no more than we would otherwise have spent on institutional care. We manage them in two different aggregate budgets. One is a budget that is used for CADI, CAC, and brain injury as one budget, and then another one is set in place for people who are on the developmental disabilities waiver. Over the past few years, there's been a number of legislative changes that have led to the elimination and significant reduction in waiting lists as we've gone forward. Some of these changes have given us more flexibility. So, for example, in 2013, there was authority given to the state to move money between counties and tribal nations as they needed it. So we'd give them a budget but work with them, and if it looked as though somebody needed it and somebody else wouldn't, we could move those dollars around. We also, prior to some legislative changes, if a county overspent their aggregate budget, they actually had to repay it, and that was with county dollars, property tax dollars. So that was changed. As long as the state as a whole was within our spending, we could develop corrective action plans, which gave counties an opportunity to correct whatever overspending was going on, or in some cases, it was spending that we needed to supplement and actually transfer funds into their budget. We also established clear expectations through different legislative action as we've implemented that, where counties are to use 97% of their waiver budgets if they have a waiting list. So before, counties would hold a reserve. They were worried about having to pay back money if they overspent, and they were worried that if people's needs changed, they wouldn't have enough money to meet their needs. Now that we can move money more easily between counties, we are finding that counties are able to spend more of their reserves because they can trust that we will bring money to them if they have an unexpected need. Also, statutory limits on the CADI waiver enrollment expired in 2015. Following that, that meant that there is no longer a waiting list for CADI because people were able to access it as they needed to. Just to give you a little bit of idea of what this really looked like, when we talk about the CADI, CAC, and VI waivers, we transferred funds 29 times during fiscal year 2017. We had lead agencies, were able to serve more people, and we actually saw spending increase to 97% of the available funds, which was up from 95% the previous year. And there are no more waiting lists for CADI as we've gone forward. The DD waiver, which again is a separate aggregate average, we had transferred funds 34 times during calendar year 2016. There are some differences in how we manage these two aggregate budgets. The counties were using 94% of available funds, which is up from 93%. This is a program that is seeing people with increasing needs as they're getting older. And we also are seeing facilities close. So sometimes counties are planning ahead and their spending is going to occur over a longer period of time. At this time, the average length of time for someone on the DD waiting list is 79 days. And this is a big improvement from times when people went on the waiting list and sometimes they were on for years and it was difficult to anticipate when they would be able to receive services. As of January 1st of this year, we had 89 people who were on the DD waiting list. So we're at the point of not talking about a waiting list as much as talking about managing reasonable pay standards, of looking at how long is it that people have to wait and how can we assure that we're giving them access to services in a more reasonable period of time. So this is a good news story. We have more people accessing services. We actually have seen a great number of efficiencies where we really are seeing more people being served, and the average cost of those services is not increasing as rapidly as it has in the past. So I'm open for any questions about our financial management of the disability waivers.
Questions from members. Representative Loughmore.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I've been in a couple of committee meetings lately where people brought treats, but this is actually one that we should have a celebratory cake for, because I remember when the waiting lists were over 5,000 and people, their only hope to get off the list was if something terrible happened to their caregiver or their needs got greater than had originally been assessed, and you had to make really tough choices, or counties did, about who to serve when there were so many waiting and needing and wanting to have those independent living services. So to get to that less than 3 months waiting is really impressive, and thank you.
Other comments or questions? All right. Ms. Bartolak, if you want to stay, you can, but I think we're going to transition to the discussion on the CMS notification on DWRS rates. And Ms. Wilson and Ms. Kutza, I hope I said that correctly.
Good. Thank you.
We're going to lead that presentation, so welcome to the committee. If you could formally announce yourself to the committee, that would be appreciated, then proceed with your presentation.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Claire Wilson. I'm an assistant commissioner at the Department of Human Services. I presented in front of you yesterday on opioids and went fairly quickly, as was duly noted. This, however, is a far more complex and complicated topic, so I am going to go much more slowly and also just provide a little bit of context for what brought us to this moment. So, as you are by now well aware, the department notified our legislative leadership on February 27th that guidance had been received on February 15th from CMS that had impacted the rates that we pay to home and community-based service providers under the disability waiver rate setting system. So I'm going to walk through just a bit of the history to what brought us to this moment, and then I want to address the actions that the department took between the time that we were notified by CMS and the time that communication went to the legislature. And finally, I just want to address one option that the department considers a viable way to address concerns that we have heard from the legislators and stakeholders. So in 2013, and this is in your letter, so don't be shocked. We're not going to walk through every year since 2013, but starting in 2013, the Minnesota legislature authorized the Department of Human Services to implement a statewide rate-setting methodology for our disability waiver services. At the time, Minnesota was under a corrective action plan by CMS due to our inconsistent rate-setting methods throughout the state. Failure to comply with the corrective action plan put us in jeopardy of losing our disability waivers, our federal funding for our disability waivers. The new system, the Disability Waiver Rate Setting System, or the DWRS, established a consistent formula for setting rates for our waivered programs. Implementation of the DWRS, as well as other changes required by the Corrective Action Plan, brought our four disability waivers into federal compliance. To comply with CMS requirements, DWRS established rate formulas that we refer to as the frameworks. They are based on a statewide average cost required to provide home and community-based services. This ensures both that the state pays the appropriate value for the cost of services and that people have access to the services statewide. State statute details the rate-setting frameworks, including the value of the cost components used to calculate the rates. Now, this was a major change to the way in which these services were paid for. So in order to give providers an opportunity to adjust to the DWRS system, in 2013, the legislature enacted rate banding, which is also called rate stabilization. So during which rates for most providers would be prevented from increasing or decreasing by more than a specified amount. Rates that are banded then are held to the rate in place for an individual as of December 31st, 2013, and are minimally impacted by the DWRS system. Rate banding was originally established for a 5-year period. Over time, it's been extended to a 6th year, and there is a 7th year of banding currently awaiting federal approval. So currently, approximately 73% of home and community-based services are subject to banding. The 6-year banding will end on December 31st, 2019. To account for the inflationary changes over time, state law requires DWRS cost components to be updated every 5 years according to changes in wage and consumer price index. The first automatic adjustment occurred in July of 2017 and resulted in an average cost increase of 8.5%. Now, again, these are based on statewide averages, so not every provider who was unbanded received the 8.5. Some received less. Prior to the first data-based automatic inflationary adjustment and the full implementation of DWRS, the legislature also authorized separate rate increases in 2013 and in 2014. The adjustments were authorized by the legislature as part of an effort to increase direct care staff wages and offset other cost of living increases. These adjustments, totaling 7%, are applied as an after-model factor to the cost-based rate structure. Implementing both the automatic inflationary adjustments and the after-model rate increases to offset provider cost results in a total average of a 15.5% increase. Again, that is an average if both the after model and the in modeling rate increases are applied. And again, that is to a very small number of providers, only those who are currently unbanded. So prior to the 2017 session, MMB notified the legislature about the duplicate adjustments. In the 2017 legislative session, the governor proposed to clarify the interaction between the automatic inflationary adjustments and the after model rate increases, so that the rate structure would appropriately reflect the cost. The legislature did choose not to make the recommended changes, And so, therefore, both adjustments were implemented in July of 2017, and the state updated the November 2017 forecast accordingly, which brings us to now, February of 2018. When CMS notified the department that it had determined that the rate increases enacted in 2013 and 2014 are duplicative of the inflationary adjustments within the formulas, and the methodology should be adjusted to remove the duplication. We had in front of CMS a package of amendments that included the new employment services that the legislature authorized in 2017. With the timing of the guidance such that it was, literally days before the release of the forecast, and with a package of amendments in front of CMS that were had the potential to be disallowed, the department had to act quickly and had to coordinate both internally with our federal relations team, with legal, with policy, and externally with MMB to determine the appropriate course of action. This was a really difficult and challenging time frame, and not a way that we typically like to take action. But that was the time frame under which we were acting and the pressures under which we were. It was not ideal. My colleague Alex Kutza is going to walk us more closely through the numbers and the forecast implications and the essential steps that we took after consultation. But I will say that moving forward, we know that cost components used to calculate rates must be outlined and justified. CMS has not disallowed this funding entirely into the waiver rate setting system. They're clarifying that it must be applied within the database rate structure. An effort to address direct care staff wages, which the initial rate increases authorized by the legislature were intended to do, can be achieved if these dollars are applied to the rate calculations of service providers. In other words, if we can distribute this funding through the framework and there's reasonable justification and an ability to monitor cost rather than as after-model adjustments. This not only would continue to keep the state's DWRS in compliance with federal regulations, but it would allow the state to maintain an equitable rate-setting methodology that reflects cost, promotes sustainability, and actively addresses the workforce shortage. And I just want to say that the workforce shortage is the crisis at hand. Home and community-based services are essential to ensuring that Minnesotans have access to quality care across the state. They enable people to live and work in the community. It is imperative that the DWRS remain in compliance with CMS and that the service delivery system is stabilized and accessible statewide. Now, we have staff who have been working on the DWRS since its inception, and they are committed to assuring that its continued evolution is both compliant with federal regulations and responsive to the workforce shortage. We are more than happy to continue to provide technical assistance on this approach. And with that, I'm going to let Alex walk through the actions that the department took.
Welcome to the committee. If you could just give your name for the presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Alex Kutza. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the Department of Human Services. I also was here yesterday, but talking about IAAs rather than this. So I'm going to quickly walk through what we did in the forecast. I know you had a presentation on the forecast last week by our forecast team, and they highlighted this as an issue. So what we did for fiscal year 18, as Ms. Wilson said, this was actually implemented on July 1st, 2017. So the in-model inflationary adjustment for banded providers went into effect on that date, and how we treat it in the forecast is that we paid for that with all state funds for the entire fiscal year. This approach ensured that we could meet notice requirements and also that we could deal with operational issues such as systems changes that need to be put in place before we could take out the duplicative rates in the system. In the forecast for fiscal year 19 moving forward, what we did for the non-banded rates, they will receive the in-model inflationary adjustment, which is a statewide average of 8.5%. This will be matched with the federal share based on our guidance that we received from CMS. For banded rates, they will continue to receive the 7% after-model rate increases as they had previously. This approach removes the duplication and maintains the federal share. And the overall impact in the forecast, the net impact is a $9.6 million savings in 18 and 19 and a $54.7 million savings in 2021, and that is the state share savings. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Questions for either one of the presenters. Representative Constant.
Why, thank you, Mr. Chair. Does Olivia Anderson, is she on your staff?
Ms. Wilson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, she is.
Representative Considine.
She contacted me about my bill and has promised me some, and I've not heard from her since. Could I speak to you afterwards, please?
Ms. Wilson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, you can. Anyone's welcome to contact me after this hearing. Quite available.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Wilson, you know, this DWRS system has been a challenge for us ever since it was first proposed. Providers don't seem to understand it well. We as policymakers don't seem to. Every time we hear about it, there's another adjustment, another problem, another delay for another year, and yet the information, and then we put the legislative auditor on trying to figure out, well, why are some of our costs higher than the nation for some of these services, and yet our wage scales are less, and we are in a workforce shortage. And we were told that partly it was because we didn't have the cost numbers to the detail that anyone could ever figure that out. Can you help us address the situation of what's been going on and what you know about what has happened to direct service wages since in the last few years as you've been going through all the adjustments you've made? You know, for us, the question is, are we moving forward in creating a sustainable system with a sustainable, reliable, trustworthy workforce? And I think the complexity of the system has really thwarted all of our abilities to achieve that goal. But we trust you to understand the system you're administering, we hope. If you don't, then it's absolutely time to throw it out. But what can you tell us as lay policymakers of what progress have we made on the policy direction we've been giving you year after year to make the system more sustainable and to have the kind of workforce that people with disabilities need to depend on?
Ms. Wilson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, I am going to start to answer that question. And I will say that it is an incredibly complex rate-setting system. And so I may ask for some assistance in answering this question in its entirety. But I will say this. You know, the cost components that are in DWRS, they vary by service. And within each of them, there are factors such as staff wages and employee benefits. And other pieces, and we are and you know, one of our challenges is assuring that we are collecting all of the necessary data as we continue to build up the framework. Now, there has not necessarily been ongoing delays. What I would say is that the legislature has continued to authorize the extension of banding. So one of the challenges that represents is that it's difficult to begin to collect data on the frameworks because so many of the services are still banded. So as we work to provide the right kind of in-modeling adjustments, you know, some of that data is more difficult because not all of the, you know, many of the services and individuals are still banded. And I don't know if, Alex, would you like to add? I'm going to ask Alex Bartolik to join me.
Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Loeffler. A couple ways of thinking about it, just to add to the fact that we have a lot of banded services, so many providers are projecting what they will have available in the future, and there are a number that will see increases, there are some that will see decreases, but they're not there yet. That is a factor. However, the legislature last year authorized cost reporting, and so we are in the process of working to set up a process where we can be collecting information on a more regular basis from providers about what is happening with their business to understand particularly costs that are changing so quickly that it's difficult. The Bureau of Labor Statistics, for example, one, it doesn't contain some labor categories that are really pertinent to this field, but also we're, by the time we get those, it's several years later, and we're dealing with a crisis right now. I will say that the framework, when you think about it conceptually, includes the factors that are important for providers' businesses. And it's a great tool for the legislature as we get more information to be able to understand its staff wages, its benefits, its what it takes for indirect costs. We should be able to have really good information in order to adjust services as we go forward. We do have some information. But we will get a lot more with the cost reporting. We tried to base most of the framework on what we could get from objective sources of information, but this is such a unique industry. There's no way for providers in this industry who rely almost exclusively on Medicaid to do a lot of different ways of increasing rates or doing other things. Much of their business is very prescribed, and so we need to be getting information in such a way that you can actually make the policy decisions. So I think there actually is a lot of progress being made, but it is very difficult to see the effects of that when so many services are still banded and those providers have not been able to capture some of the changes, particularly when you look across the state.
Follow-up, Representative Loeffler.
Yes, as a follow-up, Mr. Chair and Ms. Bartolik, I think in the absence, I mean, we're always in transition to something, it seems like, and the data is never easily accessible, and then you have to have it audited, and it's 2 years old, but at least you have something. In the absence of that, it would be really useful if you would start to collect the kind of information that can give us real-time access to what's happening on. If you had every agency report shift misses, where someone didn't show up or they weren't able to fill a shift, and have a simple code for what happened then. It was dumped on the family to fill in the blank. The person didn't go to school. The person didn't go to their work. What so that we have some real understanding of what the personal costs of this are, as well as, you know, how we can assist the industry and the workers and the families and the persons, more importantly, the persons receiving the services, to get into something. And, you know, it's otherwise we're all dealing with anecdotes and really at a loss. And people can't wait. When they're you know, when you have family members giving up careers so that they can't, you know, save for their retirement and it may not be able to get back into their profession because they can't trust a reliable system, we've got a problem. And we, you know, we've worked so hard to get people with disabilities into the work world. If they're not reliable workers, that because they can't get the supports they need to get out of bed and get onto transport, then that sets us back in getting more employers willing to step up and offer them employment. And the disability community has the highest unemployment rate of any group, any population group in Minnesota. And so, you know, please think creatively about what you can do without waiting for expensive systems to get implemented amongst all of the many interactions that you have to have. But what can you give us in terms of real time that can help us assess the seriousness of the circumstances and how we can help?
Ms. Bartolik, any response?
Mr. Chair and Representative Loeffler, we're happy to lay out what we do know, and we do know quite a bit, as well as where we have gaps and provide technical assistance if there's particular ways that might be helpful in helping us fill those gaps. But we certainly want to use the information and forward it on. The workforce crisis is real, absolutely, and it's changing so quickly that it's really forcing many people to be thinking very differently about how to deliver services.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sure everybody here understands this except me, right? Because this is really, I find this stuff really confusing. So I started out sort of with, I think, somewhat the same question as Representative Loeffler in that kind of wanting to know what's happening to wages. And I think the answer is we don't really have good information on that. Is that, let me just start there. Is that kind of accurate?
Ms. Bartolik.
Mr. Chair and Representative, we know what values are in the components that we have said are in there to pay wages. Providers aren't obligated to limit themselves to that or to solely use it there. We can share that information. We do have some information from surveys from providers about wages that are paid, but we need additional information on a routine basis to answer that question about how are providers using those dollars with wages and benefits.
Representative. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know the answers are never simple answers, but that's the nature of the beast. It's not your fault. But so that my other question, we heard the report about electronic visit verification system. Now we're talking about the disability waiver rate system. So could you just step back a minute and talk about, you know, part of what makes this all really confusing is that we talk about different kinds of services for different categories of people, and it's really hard to kind of keep track of who we're talking about and what we're talking about. So could you just step back and tell us, in this disability waiver rate system, I know it's home and community-based services, just what kind of services are those? And then the electronic visit verification system, what kind of services are those? Are they the same? Are they different? Who are we talking about here?
Ms. Bartolik.
Mr. Chair and Representative, home and community-based services is a broad category that refers to a number of funding streams that can support people to live outside of institutions. It includes, in that umbrella term, it includes services that are available through our Medicaid state plan, such as personal care assistance or nursing services, things that are available to people if they're eligible for them. It also includes waiver services or home and community-based waiver services under that broad umbrella. When we're talking about the electronic visit verification, that applies to a subset of those services. And it's really designed to apply to services that are delivered where a person is by someone who's acting independently. I mean, they're not in a setting with a supervisor and managers who are watching people clock in and out. It's not a group setting. It's when people are in their own home or bringing someone and supporting them in a work site or out in the community. And it's designed to start with the personal care assistance, what we know here. When somebody's helping a person do things they might not be able to do for themselves, it's helping them with eating and with their personal cares and taking care of their basic household. It's a great service, but it's also one that's done by people who receive very low wages. And as dedicated as they may be, there isn't a lot of oversight of those services other than the person who's delivering the services. And so the EVV is designed to focus on those services that are really about supporting people with things that need to be done to help them care for themselves in their home. There are other home and community-based waiver services that might be done in a day training and rehabilitation center, that might be done in a residential setting where you have a supervisor and shift staff. Those, with the caveat, we're still waiting for additional guidance. We don't think that that's really as much of the focus because there's a supervisor or there's somebody there. There's more accountability to each other within that setting.
So, Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So last year, the OLA had a report on our waiver services and, you know, talked about needing to have some additional information collected, and I had some legislation. Some of it got passed, some of it didn't. I think this was legislation that came from the department, and some of it was the need to collect more granular information. I think the kind of information we're talking about in the EVV system is that. Could you kind of? I guess the question I want to ask is, even when we get this EVV thing completely implemented and so on, is there still a need to, well, who is it that we still don't really get enough granular information about that we really still need to, because, you know, that report that from the OLA talked about the billions of dollars we spend on these services. And, you know, of course, I think Minnesotans generally want to provide those services. I mean, this is important stuff, and we pride ourselves on the sort of service that we deliver to people with disabilities, and we want to do better and better on that. But it is a lot of money. So we really need to know that the money is going where it's supposed to go and serving the people it's supposed to serve. And my understanding was that there was a gap where we weren't collecting enough information to really be able to answer some of those questions. So could you just kind of, how does that piece fit with all of this that we've been talking about today?
Ms. Bartok.
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, the electronic visit verification is really assuring that any services billed were delivered and assuring that there aren't mistakes made in billing and that we have integrity in that process. Some of the information we need comes from providers about what their costs are. We can look at certain state or national benchmarking on what certain standards might be, but again, with a system that is in this crisis of trying to manage workforce the way it is, we want to be able to get information from providers. Some of the legislation that passed will allow us to get information to understand what are the provider costs and to be able to do public reporting. So we can also give you information about these are areas where we seem to be, our rate framework actually is sufficient, and here are areas where we are really having difficulty, providers are having difficulty. There may be a need for more specificity around workforce. I think the idea of retention, what are some of the recruitment costs, training costs, average wages, some of those things we may be able to get it in the cost data, but it's important in order to really be able to understand are the strategies that are being taken, both by providers in different ways of managing their business as well as the legislature. Are they making a difference? And are they making a difference for some industry, parts of the industry, but not others? Or some parts of the state, but not others? We do need that information to really understand by service, by part of the state, by certain types of disabilities. It might be that there's certain stresses in the ability of providers to meet certain needs without trained staff in a particular area. We want to be able to provide that information. That's what we're in the process of setting up.
I understand. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for this report and for talking about the waivers, et cetera, today. I think it's important. I am listening to you talk about the adjustments that you're making, and one of the things you said, Ms. Bartolik, was that because of the workforce shortage, that we are working quickly, if I understand, correct me if I'm wrong about this, working quickly to adapt, to adapt to and make sure that we are making change so that we can continue to provide services, I'm paraphrasing loosely. And as I think about people living with disabilities across the state, you know, I get this, and I'm sure you do too, this clear message that people are living in some cases worried that they're not going to have a care provider available to them, feeling isolated in a community, wherever they live in the state, but I think maybe even more exacerbated in greater Minnesota. And I know it is all of our concern and all of our problem that we have a workforce shortage, and it's not just in this community but in others. But I want to just underscore, I think, as you talk through the methods by which we're going to try and attack it and reforming expectations, that there are some basic things, especially for vulnerable people, in terms of a well-prepared staff who are prepared to take care of people who are vulnerable, and that they are well compensated and well trained. And I see you nodding, and I'm glad about that part. But sometimes in this committee, and when I think about all of the things that we're looking at here and all of the efforts that are underway to try and accommodate or move through this period of time when we have workforce shortages, and those are more acutely felt in the hard human service jobs that don't pay that well. I don't want us to forget that in order to attract a skilled workforce, they need to be connected to one another, they need to be well-trained, and they need to be well-compensated. And that is a part of our job in the legislature to make sure that there's funding able, and I think we're falling short there. It's one of the reasons why we're struggling in the terms of the legislative budget right now. But I also just want to underscore, right, that reform by itself can't always solve the problem. And there are basics in terms of training and in-person training and connectivity among people who are doing this work, especially when they're working individually in homes. And well-compensated staff, which is a foundation for the work that we need to do.
Any response, Ms. Bartolak or Ms. Wilson?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, those are all points that are well taken. And as you noted, I mean, it's a crisis that we're seeing across all of the different, you know, all of our different sectors. And so connecting workers to one another and recognizing that in all of these settings, these are incredibly high-stress jobs, particularly given the lack, you know, given the shortages. So that the connectedness is a key component.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the presenters. I do have a little bit more questions on some of the information you're presenting. Is one of the statements I heard is that providers are being more creative. To me, that's kind of concerning. What does creative mean when there's a shortage and how they're addressing with it? Addressing with, like, specifics.
Ms. Bartoli.
Mr. Chair and Representative Fisher, some providers are looking at how technology can help supplement their staff, both in terms of can it help support a person where maybe they wouldn't need a person there as long as there were certain terms of technology. Also, some providers are using technology to help staff do their jobs more efficiently so that they are able to focus their time where it's most important. People are looking at different models. We get a number of ideas all the time from providers who are looking at different ways of doing services. And last year, the legislature authorized us to proceed with some services, for example, that are a combination of paying for staff, but we're also paying for intermittent staff, meaning instead of just paying for every 15-minute unit when somebody's there, we're able to pay for the fact that somebody needs to be available even though their time might be intermittent, and also to cover some of the cost of technology. And that's being used when people are living perhaps in apartment settings where maybe three or four people are living in a larger apartment setting and a provider can be there. It was something they brought to us as a way of trying to support it. Providers have all kinds of ideas about ways of recruiting and supporting staff. The point about supervision is key, and we see a number of agencies who are doing different things with how to supervise and really support staff to feel that they can do a good job. Those are a few examples. We, last year in 2016, I guess that's not just last year, the time is going by, but in 2016, we held a workforce shortage summit, and there's been continued to be work following that. And that has been a really good way of looking at different strategies. And we have some information that's going to the Olmstead subcabinet about categories where people really think it's important. Could we do something with high school and college students on an AmeriCorps-type piece? Could we do credits if people work while they go to college so that they're filling a gap? There's a lot of ideas that have come from providers as well as others, as well as people who use services have a lot of ideas, too, about what could be done differently. So we do have information that I'd be happy to forward on to you as soon as that report is completed.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Bartel, thank you. I'd be curious to know more on that. And the other question I had is, you know, we keep on hearing the shortages out there, but I haven't heard any recent numbers. What are the recent numbers that we're looking at? And I know it might look different depending what the positions are, and I can see if you get kind of an idea of, you know, which areas have got the biggest shortage and what those numbers are looking like. Are we talking tens of thousands, thousands, those, you know, complexity?
Ms. Bartolik.
You're talking tens of thousands. Mm-hmm. And we have a hard time sometimes understanding vacancies. We can look at the amount of service that isn't being billed. Providers have that data about vacancies, which is why we need some of that. But you just have to look at the state demographer information to look at, we have 8,000 new people a year coming into our workforce compared to 12,000 a decade before. We just have fewer people entering the workforce. And that is, we can get you that information from the state demographer. It is very frightening information because it's affecting everything in our state. It's workers across all industries.
Follow-up, Representative Fisher?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. It'd be good to have a little bit more information as to, you know, the exact areas and how many totals that we're looking at right now. And I understand that it floats up and down a little bit, and it's probably getting worse each year instead of better. Help give us an idea what that problem.
Any other questions for the presenters? I'm told that some members would also like to hear from Mr. Goodnow, so I'm asking Mr. Goodnow to approach the bench. Mr. Goodnow, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kevin Goodnow. I am here representing the Minnesota Organization for Habilitation and Rehabilitation, or MOR. It's one of the an association of one of the provider groups that provide day services that is impacted by the recent direction that was given by CMS. I'm also representing a broader coalition, the Best Life Alliance, that includes the residential services and other providers that fall under the category that are also impacted by that. I appreciate the opportunity to just say a few words in front of you. The letter that was issued by Acting Commissioner Johnson on February 27th, I think has some, if not errors, it has some representations that we disagree with. Let me just put it that way, and I'd like to point those out. But I do want to say that this direction given by CMS that will impact providers is a big deal. Will impact providers and individuals. It cuts their rates by 7%. Some of them won't see it immediately, but they'll see it when the banning comes off. But some of them will see it on July 1st. And so let me just give you a little bit of a point on a few things. First of all, in the letter it stated that there's a stacking or implied that providers would see a 15.5% increase and that some providers saw that. I will say that if you look at the rates on June 30th, 2017, as compared to when the inflationary adjustment was put on the system on July 1st, 2017, nobody saw a 15.5% rate increase. There was an inflationary adjustment that resulted in an 8.5% increase, but nobody saw a 15.5% increase. What they're doing to get to that number was adding the 7% of rate increases that took place in the previous 3 to 4 years. So let me just back up to those. So when they talk about, or when folks talk about, and CMS talks about the inflationary adjustments and adding an inflationary adjustment on top of another inflationary adjustment, what they're talking about is the inflationary adjustment that was passed in 2013 that was embedded in the rate setting methodology system, and then adding to that the rate increases that took place in the 2013 session and the 2014 session. So those rate increases, just to walk through those, there was one that went in effect on April 1st, 2014. That was passed by the 2013 legislature. It was a 1% rate increase. It was not defined as to how that money was to be used. It was just a rate increase, and it didn't say why it was being added on. On July 1st, 2014, the 5% campaign rate increase went into effect. That rate increase that went with that was to deal with the workforce shortage. It was dedicated to wages. But there is also a requirement in the statute that says you cannot receive this increase unless you file a quality report under certain, with that outlines certain requirements to it. And so that had a quality component that had a wage issue related to it. That was passed in the 2014 session. And then finally, the other 1% was enacted in July 1st, 2015. That was also passed in 2013. I know I'm throwing a lot of dates at you. That is strictly and very specifically dedicated to a quality add-on. No mention of inflationary adjustment, no mention of it related to wages. It was a quality add-on. Somehow CMS got in its mind that that 7%, that 1, that 5, and that 1, was an inflationary adjustment. What it was really meant to was a combination of quality rate increases and quite frankly, the workforce shortage issue that we're facing. There are, as Ms. Bartolik mentioned, an impact of tens of thousands. I know one provider in the residential area that talks about having 1,200 openings that they can't fill. We know and we keep hearing about folks that can't hire enough people to serve the needs of the individuals that are already hired, that they're being served, and people are being churned away. That's workforce shortage. That doesn't deal with the cost of living adjustment. When we look at potential solutions here, we have something we've talked about and worked with the Department of Human Services on that I think is a potential solution as we move forward. But let me address a few other things in the letter, and then I'll go to that. I won't take much longer. They also mentioned earlier that this is a cost-based system. It does have a relative relationship to cost, but when the new formula was put into place, the previous to the rate-setting methodology put into place, you had negotiated rates that would vary from county to county and sometimes by caseworker to caseworker with different providers. So you did not have a uniform system whatsoever. The feds didn't like that because they felt there would be inequities in that system. Pretty hard to argue against that. But when you go to a uniform statewide methodology, you have winners or losers. The rates before reflected costs, relative costs to the providers that were receiving those rates. Now we're forcing people to either adjust their costs down or raise their costs up related to what we feel is a statewide methodology. But I want to make a note on that is that, for example, our base wage index, which is the very beginning point of the formula, that's based on Bureau of Labor Statistics data that's collected for and reflects relatively the job categories we're talking about, but it's a median statewide average. It does not reflect the cost of providing services in the metro area. It may not reflect the true cost of providing services any place in the state because it's the median, and it's a statewide average, not a metro-wide average. So, you know, we have to be careful about thinking that the system is actually cost-based. It really isn't cost-based, and it's certainly not cost-based on a provider-by-provider basis. The other thing that we've shifted away from the discussion in the letter about it being an inflationary adjustment and on top of an inflationary adjustment to it's not within the framework, and we can't recognize that increase if it's outside the framework. I'm not exactly certain why it's important to have a 7% or 1% quality add-on actually be in Section 256B.4914 in order for it to be okay. But if we have to move it there for it to be okay, but if it's outside of that section, it's not okay. I don't really get that rationale. I think it should be more about what the purpose of it is rather than where it's located in the state statute. But I guess that's a CMS issue that we need to deal with. As far as the potential solution, Representative Schumacher dropped the bill the day after the forecast came out and this money went out of the forecast. And that's the big issue about it is when they decided, when CMS said we're giving you direction to not add on the 7%, MMB decided they're going to drop the appropriation related to that to the bottom line. And so you're part of the surplus that you saw released on February 28th reflected the savings related to not giving the 7% increase. So just understand, I believe that is in the neighborhood of $9.6 million in this biennium and about $55 million in the next biennium. That makes up part of that surplus. And that's part of that 7% cut. We fortunately had been working with DHS prior to this news, the pre-CMS direction, about how we can take that 7% and embed it into the framework. So we had a solution that we were working on. DHS gave us some really great technical assistance. They did an analysis of the DSP workforce, the direct care workers, and how much they get paid and what their education and training requirements are, and compared that to other job classifications that had similar training and education requirements. And what they found was there's about 11% difference. It shows that these folks are being underpaid as compared to other folks with similar education by about 11%. We're working on legislation and amendment that would actually build that into the framework so we could try to close that gap, between what DSPs are getting paid and what other folks with the same training levels were getting paid as well. So that's where we're at. I didn't know. I know you, Mr. Chairman, you asked, some people wanted to hear from me. I don't know if they just wanted to hear my voice or if this was the information that they wanted to hear, but I'm happy to answer any questions people may have.
Well, anyone can hardly argue with the dulcet tones of, you know, Mr. Goodnow, so. But are there any questions?
Mr. Chairman, you must not have met my teenage daughters.
We all have our moments. Any questions for Mr. Goodnow, Representative Loeffler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Goodnow, we've been talking about the workforce shortage, which we all recognize. Can you, even though we don't have statewide data out of the Department of Human Services, tell us what's happening in the people you represent in their entry-level wage scales and how are they prioritizing that within their budgets? Because there have been increases, and inflation in general has been much less than 7%. And so how, what are we seeing at that wage on the ground level within your members?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Goodnow. Representative Loeffler, I don't have that exact information. I will get some. I wasn't prepared to actually speak in front of you today. We typically have a provider here that could provide me some of that information. I do have to say that the inflation factor doesn't necessarily match with the increase in wages that we're seeing and the competition we're having on the wage side. And so in some communities, for example, up in Thief River Falls, I know that one of the biggest challenges that we have is that we're paying a $10 to $12 an hour, but we have a large company down the road that's paying $15, $16 starting. And in some cases, we have clients, recipients that we're providing services for that are getting paid more per hour than some of the support staff they have with them. Now, that's anecdotal, and I don't have exactly, but depending upon the community, you have different competitors for those jobs. But I will get you some information, the information we have on that, and I can find it in different, but it will vary from provider to provider. Just one thing to keep in mind, we do have a mix of the priority for this is really to keep and maintain your workforce. We have a lot of turnover in our workforce right now. The more turnover we have, the more costly it is, and the services suffer because of that. So one of the priorities is to really put an emphasis either on the benefit side or the wage side. In some communities and what some providers feel that the benefits are more important to increase and keep them at a high level than the wages. But we also have this whole issue of where are we going to be at when banning comes off. We have the HCBS rule coming down from the federal government and a number of other things that I won't get into that have made this world very unstable. The other thing I would just warn you on, the increased reporting requirements that we have, people have to do that. So to the extent that DHS wants more data, we have to dedicate staff people to provide that data, and we have to pay for those staff people to provide that data. So I would just ask, to the extent they're asking for data, make sure you're going to use it or that it's meaningful and that it's not data that just is being collected so it sits there. And that's, I'm not reflecting on what you're asking for, but we get a lot of requests for information and forms and different things that do add to our cost of providing services as well.
So. Any further questions for Mr. Goodnow? We certainly appreciate your time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members.
Members, our next meeting is Thursday, March 8th. And one of the reports that will be on tomorrow's agenda is the adverse health events report. It is over 100 pages long, members, and so we're not going to be including it in the packet in your folder unless you specifically tell Ms. Larson that you would like a paper copy. The document is posted on our webpage, and so I would direct your attention to that if you do not request a paper copy. With that, members, this meeting is adjourned.